This morning I'll be talking a bit about the issue of transgender people. Throughout November, people have been talking about transgender people in ceremonies, in rallies, in commemorative services. These readings prepare the way for my sermon. The first reading comes from the lauded and yet quite controversial novel, The Salt Eaters, by Tony Cade Bambara. It was written in 1980.
People who sometimes believed that it was safer to live with complaints, that it was necessary to cooperate with grief, that it was all right to become an accomplice in self-ambush, would then take heart to flat out decide to be well and stride into the future, sane and whole.
The second reading consists of words written by Lauren Cameron, a well-known San Francisco photographer who I met a long time ago when he modeled for a drawing class I took when I lived in the Bay Area. This is from his 1996 book, Body Alchemy.
The first time I marched in the San Francisco Pride Parade in 1994, I wanted to absorb it all and fix the moment in my mind forever. I wanted to watch people's reactions to us, and more than anything, I wanted to walk with dignity. As we passed, a silence fell over the crowd until we heard a timid offering of applause, occasionally punctuated by an outbreak of cheers. I glanced at my comrades to see their broad smiles when we heard hurrahs. Every now and then, I glimpsed in the crowd a face full of contempt for us, or saw an acquaintance who pretended not to see my wave. I felt a disturbing jumble of sadness and angry defiance. I forced myself to look into their eyes until they turned away. Whether she or he has marched in a parade or not, I think every transsexual understands what we felt that day. Each of us has had to take a stand about our identity. When I photograph transsexuals, men or women, I ask about their histories. I know they have labored to arrive at the place where I found them. They tell me about losing jobs and friends while going through the transition and how they fought to keep them. They talk about the people who love them and how difficult it is to make them understand. I see the strain in their faces as they speak to me, and I know they've been through so much. But more than anything, I hear the relief in their voices. Satisfied with their changed bodies, they each tell me how much better they feel and that they would do it all again if they had to. I marvel at their strength. Like tempered steel, it is the kind that propels armies and liberationists, a single-minded conviction. When I look through my lens at them, I recognize the power of such willfulness. I want the world to know the force of their beauty.
If you keep up with the news, and many do in this congregation, you will have noticed, I have to imagine, a large number of stories recently having to do with bullying and with persons taking their own lives because they cannot cope with the constant ridicule and badgering they receive, because they won't conform to someone else's view of how things are supposed to be. Sometimes these are kids, and many of them are kids, perceived as gay or lesbian by their tormentors. But many times this bullying has to do not with sexuality, but with punishing someone who appears to cross the culturally demanded boundaries between the two major genders. More on that phrase, major genders, later. I hope nobody is thinking that this situation is new and that suddenly our society has a new problem to deal with, bullying. Bullying with the tacit approval of right-wing religious institutions like Focus on the Family is a new form of bullying, I'll admit that. But bullying itself is quite ancient, been around a long time. Oh, and internet bullying is a new form of bullying, too, because the internet itself is new. But bullying itself is old, been around for millennia. Bullies perceive any nonconformity in gender expression, in sexual expression, or even as our own Unitarian Universalist history makes clear in theological expression, as an actual threat. Bullies may be found among the powerful in any society, or they may be ordinary individuals without much power who have bought into the preachments of the powerful, even though they themselves often feel powerless. For example, Brandon Tina lived long before this present spate of bullying. Some of you may remember Brandon. 17 years ago, he was a Nebraska teenager living as a male. He was just beginning to seek out medical help to help him change his body, which was born female. He was cruelly bullied and humiliated by a man enraged by the very fact of transgenderism. Because of his rage, he shot and killed Brandon in cold blood, as well as every other person in the house that night. They eventually made a movie about this called Men Don't Cry, but I assure you, men do cry. In that same year as Brandon Tina was killed, I had the sad duty at my former congregation to lead a memorial service for a 12-year-old. I had named him when he was a baby. I had held him in my arms. It was at the Christmas Eve service, and I remember that he cried. By age 12, he had already figured out that he was gay. Though he was absolutely loved and adored by his very positive UU family, Unitarian Universalist family, and he was remarkably adored, he did attend a junior high where, sadly, he saw the handwriting on the wall. He was bullied and ridiculed daily for his nonconformist, very gentle behavior. Kids like him, he figured, would end up dealing with harassment far more than dealing with books in school. And so one day, he simply took his own life. with his mother's police gun. It was the saddest memorial service I have ever had to do. His loving parents and grandparents figured out exactly why he did what he did, but of course they will never be the same for the rest of their lives. So now, bullying for nonconformity is hardly new. Just some forms of it are new, and just reporting it is new. Hanging on a wall in my loft as you enter the door is a simple, elegant etching of two men facing each other. It was a gift, and it's a very precious gift, from Marguerite or Marge Turnbull, whose memorial service we offered here on Tuesday. She and her late husband, Bob, were downsizing their living quarters, moving from a house into an apartment, and they thought that I, as a gay man, might enjoy a fine piece of art, which they wanted to give away along with other possessions. The etching shows Antinous and Hadrianus, two men from ancient Rome who were madly in love. "You would get who they are, since you like history," said Marguerite to me. Since one of these two men was privileged indeed, being, after all, the emperor of Rome, nobody dared to bully him for his love for Antinous. Men and women without imperial rank were not treated as well, and if they crossed gender or sex behavior lines, they were often indeed bullied to conform, even in ancient Rome. Yet not long after Hadrian, another Roman citizen, Augustinus Aurelianus, whom we now call Saint Augustine, condemned all same-gender sexual behavior, including if one partner happened to be the emperor. He was also upset about one gender acting or appearing as if it was another gender, especially if a man took up the look of a woman. His reason was his very rigid understanding of the actual biology of the genders. In Contra Mendacium, written in the year 420, St. Augustine put it this way: "The body of a man is as superior to that of a woman as the soul is to the body." Augustine just thus linked gender conformity to sexual conformity. And from St. Augustine's day on, the two different areas called sexual expression and gender expression have gotten twisted into a perfect muddle. This muddle about gender surfaced throughout history. It's hard to pick them apart, separate them. The peasant teenager, Chantarc de Domremy, whom we know now by only a distorted form of her name, Joan of Arc, was burned at the stake specifically and statedly because she put on male clothes after she had conformed to the law for a while by not wearing them. This putting on of male clothes convinced the bullies who held her in prison that she was indeed a witch. Not because she dabbled in spells or cauldrons or healings, but because she did not conform to the expectations of the world, their world, any more than Brandon Tina did centuries later. Thus, in the pre-modern world before Wiccan sensibilities, her cross-dressing in male attire suggested she must have made a pact with the devil, The very idea that someone would question their own gender roles was so terrifying to the populace at large that they lost any compassion for the young French warrior as a person, a teenaged person. She was only 19 when she was condemned. After the official bullying by Cardinal Cochon in the court, they all gathered, the people there in France, to watch the screaming teenager burn. Joan of Arc died in 1431, a long time ago. However, had she lived in our own day instead of her own, and if she was indeed what we now call a transgender person, a transsexual person, the evidence is inconclusive. I acknowledge that. Modern surgical techniques would have changed the whole story if she could have afforded them. After all, unlike Hadrian, she had no privilege. She was a peasant, a poor peasant. Any of you got $75,000 in your pocket to spare? Privilege has also allowed other transgender folks to thrive and survive despite the hatred of society. I think of Queen Christina of Sweden, the famous monarch who abdicated her throne and then moved to Italy. Critical modern scholars review the stories reported about her and have come to see her as intersex. Maybe a new word for some of you. That is, a person with both male and female biological characteristics from birth. She dressed as a man most of the time and took pains to look like a man in every way. But as royalty, even abdicated royalty, she was merely seen as eccentric. Folks without privilege or wealth, however, like the male-identified illiterate peasant upstart burned at the stake, usually don't get away with refusing to conform to social expectations. Lack of privilege has often led to the suicide of transgender persons, intersex persons, and so forth, as well as to their outright murder, as in the case of Brandon Tina. Now, one of the missions of this congregation is to relinquish the safety of our unexamined privilege. This morning, I have been trying to examine a few often unaddressed issues associated with privilege and gender, although there obviously are many others. And of course, the racialization of American culture is another issue which the word privilege in our mission statement helps to question. But I think that the issue of relinquishing privilege in our mission applies very especially to gender and sexuality. Now that we hear of biologists telling us that there are far more than simply two genders, some say as many as 13. And more recently, I think of our mission when I read that when transgender men and women report, and they do, and maybe some of you have heard this, that they feel like they were born in the wrong body. They are telling the sober truth, as far as modern brain studies show, no matter what their social critics rant and rave against. Female-to-male and male-to-female transgendered persons, you see, have been shown clearly to show strong traits of the contrasting gender in their various brain structures. They're reporting truthfully their experience. That no one believes them is not their fault. But frankly, when I first read of these brain studies, their conclusion wasn't really a surprise to me. Because when I read history, I see a thousand stories about people who risked everything, including ridicule, including death, to affirm to the world that they indeed know exactly who they are. They know it. And that not one person outside of them does. When the most popular prosperity preacher on television, maybe some of you have watched him, the handsome, smiling Joel Osteen, raises his Bible every Sunday, he says of it, "I am what it says I am. I have what it says I have. I can do what it says I can do." Even though he preaches to millions every Sunday via television and gathers tens of thousands of people every Sunday at his church, which is an old stadium transformed, and even though he's very successful and has written many books, he does not speak for me. No book, or even book made of many books, which is what the Bible is, indeed, no other person, no government policy, no rule or law, no institution, no movement can tell me who I am. I am the only one who can do that. This is true for me, and it's true for you. And that is the root of all human hope, as far as I am concerned. Mariah Mitchell, raised a Unitarian in the 19th century, was, by her culture, including part of her Unitarian culture, which had hitherto refused to examine its own male privilege bias, was told all of her life that women were not only weaker than men, as St. Augustine put it, but less intellectually sound than men, and therefore had no business studying things like math or science or astronomy, since these disciplines would surely break her delicate brain. Mariah Mitchell knew inside exactly who she was, however, and defying most everyone, except her loving father, went on to become a famous astronomer, a famous teacher, the discoverer of comets, and a real whiz at math. We each have the power, I say, to know who we are, and our hope lies therein. Lucy Hitchcock, when she was looking to serve one of our congregations, only as long ago as 1980, was asked by one search committee, "Well, you know, we like you and we want you, but we have to ask that you leave your partner, a woman, back in California. Won't you do that? We can't deal with people like you here." She didn't accept their call, naturally, because she knew who she was, and so she waited till she was called elsewhere by a more thoughtful congregation. She served our congregations beautifully until retirement. We each have the power to know who we are. It's where our hope resides. Sean Parker Dennison, a transgender male who had once born children, was told that no UU congregation had ever engaged with a transgender minister before, so it would be difficult, he was told, to find a position. Still, he searched with a hopeful heart, knowing he was exactly who he was and nobody else. Finally, he was called to a wonderful congregation in suburban Salt Lake City, where he's served well and beautifully for 8 years. He's now serving as an excellent accredited interim minister in California. We each have the power that he has to know who we are on the inside and to claim it without shame. All of these stories show that if you know who you are and don't let anyone else define you, no matter what your uniqueness, then you have within you the deep roots of hope that can allow you to blossom beautifully in your life. Sometimes hope feels far away, we heard in the children's book this morning. But hope is always there. Even the book said, if you do something never done before, even if angry words burst forth from you, even if sad tears flow down your cheeks, hope is also, the book said, remembering that you're not alone. Indeed. In November, modern transgender communities have been establishing memorial services for those killed or harassed or denied ordinary access because of who they are. I've participated in them before, like the yearly service at King Avenue Methodist. Many gather to mourn, but they also gather to meet each other because we are not alone. And we have to meet each other and speak to each other to realize that. But participating in such a service does not mean that I personally have no work to do. Preaching a sermon about this does not mean I have arrived and have no personal work to do. Expressing progressive attitudes toward gender and sexuality does not mean I'm finished, that my work is done. I've made that silly assumption many times in my life, and guess what? It's always been wrong, every single time. So I'm just not going to assume that anymore. As most of you know, I lived most of my adult life in an area known for its progressive attitudes towards sexuality and gender, the San Francisco Bay Area. I knew personally and cared for many articulate people on the very cutting edge of these issues, like the great Keith Hennessy and the irrepressible Joni Blank. I thought I had arrived and knew it all, open mind, open heart, open soul. But then I met Lauren Cameron, the man on the cover of your Orders of Celebration. He's a pretty well-known photographer in San Francisco, but I didn't meet him because I needed his services as a photographer. I met him when he showed up to model at the life drawing class I used to attend religiously. I noted that Lauren was a striking man, that he was a well-developed bodybuilder, in fact. But at the time, he was still taking hormones and testosterone shots and had not transitioned all the way from the female body he had been born with. I didn't even know if that's what he wanted to do or if he could afford to do that. $75,000 is a lot of money. As I said, I met him in a life drawing class, and when he disrobed and I saw him, it was so confusing to me that I was paralyzed with questions. I couldn't draw. I spent a full hour trying to sort out my own confusing emotions and responses. Finally, by the end of the evening, Lauren's genial and upbeat attitude about himself, which he radiated, had begun to move me through my inner struggles, and I can't thank him enough for that. And he welcomed my questions afterward. But the point is, I had to work at it. I had to work hard at it, and that's why I wanted his words to be read this morning. Remember what he said about transsexuals when he photographs others like himself? More than anything, I hear the relief in their voices. Satisfied with their changed bodies, they each tell me how much better they feel and that they would do it all again if they had to. Surgery? Really? Again? Wow. I marvel at their strength, Like tempered steel, it is the kind that propels armies and liberationists, a single-minded conviction. When I look through my lens at them, I recognize the power of such willfulness. I want the world to know the force of their beauty. What rich and healing words. That's what I saw in Lauren himself that first night when he modeled for us strength, not just of body, but of spirit, power, a sacred willfulness, a force of beauty launched by the sheer acceptance of oneself, the power of knowing oneself and not letting anyone else define you. Tony Cade Bambara says much the same thing. People who sometimes believe that it was safer to live with the complaints, that it was necessary to cooperate with grief, that it was all right to become an accomplice in self-ambush, would then take heart to flat out decide to be well and stride into the future, sane and whole. Exactly. It's possible to flat out decide to be well, to stride into the future sane and whole, without allowing ourselves to be turned into accomplices in our own self-ambush, or to suffer the indignity of constant complaints and critique, or to think that it's right to grieve all the time for who we are. Grief for loss of who you are, not for being who you are, not for becoming the fullness of what can be, might be proper. But rejoice in who you are. Be glad to be who you are and who you are becoming. Bullying those who don't conform isn't new, as I said at the beginning. Reporting it is new. But even newer than that is the rising sense that allies are speaking out against the bullying, against those who hurt other people because of who they are, by vicious harassment and their sense of superior disapproval. I want to be an ally against such bullying. And I still have things to learn, and I always will. I want you to hear that. And I believe that's true of all of you, too. The vocabulary of gender and the lexicon of sexual distinctions are both large and complex. I still don't know all the words. Many words now being used, like transgender, are only a few decades old. I know that I will make many mistakes in pronoun usage and may ask questions that may make someone wince a bit because of their ignorance. But so what? To learn, to grow, to embrace, to practice the true art of hospitality, as our mission statement puts it, demands that of me. Nothing less. And why would I ever not want to do that in the first place? Or think of such spiritual growth and learning as anything less than a great, great gift.